morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, January 17th, 2019. A UN rights official calls on Sudan to stop the use of excessive force in that country's protests.
So we are calling on the government to ensure that any reports of excessive use of force, including live ammunition by the state security forces, are investigated and that they engage in a dialogue with the protesters.
And one analyst says South Sudan should stop waiting for international donors to implement the peace deal.
Well, it is time that we stop crying for outside help and start doing things for ourselves.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Police fired tear gas again in Khartoum today to disperse demonstrators chanting freedom, peace, justice as they try to march to the presidential palace where vehicles mounted with machine guns were deployed. Professional groups in the country today called for more protests in 12 cities across the country to press demands for President Omar al-Bashir to step aside after nearly 30 years in power. Officials say 24 people have died and hundreds of others have been wounded since the protests began on December 19th, after the government tripled the price of bread. Human rights groups say more than 40 people have been killed. The protests have spread to at least 14 cities and more than 1,000 people have been arrested. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says Sudanese authorities should stop using excessive force to repress peaceful anti-government demonstrations. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
Protests against fuel shortages and the rising price of bread in Sudan began nearly a month ago. These quickly turned into demands for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir, who has ruled for 30 years, and a change of government which the protesters view as deeply corrupt. Ravina Shamdasani, spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, tells VOA the government's response has only made things worse. Numerous witnesses say security forces have fired tear gas and live ammunition at peaceful protesters.
So we are calling on the government to ensure that any reports of excessive use of force, including live ammunition by the state security forces, are investigated and that they engage in a dialogue with the protesters instead of seeking to repress them.
The government confirms 24 people have died in the course of the protests. The UN says it has credible reports indicating the death toll may be twice as high. Sudanese authorities also confirm that up to January 6th, at least 816 protesters have been arrested. They reportedly include journalists, opposition leaders, and members of civil society. Shamdasani says these tactics have not deterred people from holding peaceful rallies in a number of cities across Sudan. She says they are being organized by professional doctors, lawyers, and journalist associations. So far, she says, there do not seem to be any moves toward dialogue to end the standoff.
In fact, what we have seen is that the president himself has been attending pro-government rallies while the security forces are cracking down on anti-government rallies.
Shamdasani says High Commissioner Bachelet has been in touch with Sudanese authorities. She has offered to deploy a human rights team to advise them and help ensure they act in accordance with their international human rights obligations. Shamdasani says the High Commissioner is awaiting their response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Sudanese American rights advocate Alzaz Ashami has more than 10 years of experience in public diplomacy, policy research, gender equality, and capacity building with international organizations. Ashami says the Sudan protests have now reached a tipping point where people feel they have nothing to lose.
They've heard it all. They've heard all the promises, all the wooing from the government, all the threats, but they don't think that anything is working. So to them, what left for them is just to express themselves. You know what I mean? And it's quite courageous, but at the same time, I see it as something scary to see young people willing to die. Yesterday, I saw a tweet from a girl saying that all of us going tomorrow, we need to take a shower and do two rak'ah, as like as they might die and not come back home. So this is kind of gloomy for young adults who should be worried about their future to see this very dark future ahead of them, that it's only going to be death. So it sounds very void and dark, and it's because of the excess use of violence on the part of the government. Things are still on the rise, like medicine are expensive, lines are still there. So people feel like we might as well just remain on the streets, at least as a venting mechanism for them. Yes, they were joining the protests. There were women too. And that was very interesting to see. But their slogans were different. They were like for justice and freedom. So it was not more towards toppling the regime or about poverty driven. But obviously it's in solidarity with other people who took the streets because of poverty and because of their desire for the regime to be removed.
This has been going on now for over a month, I think.
Yes, I think a month and 2 days, because these protests started like on a smaller scale, like 300 people or something in Damazin, and also it started in Atbara, Port Sudan, and others. But this started to pick up momentum, thousands of people on the streets, sometimes at once, you know, like the one that happened in El Ghassal Jamhuri, the one the professional association called for, that was like the Christmas Eve or the day before. That was huge, you know what I mean? And the aggregated number, it is in the thousands for sure. Like the one in Kassala yesterday, I don't know who left in the houses. And you're talking about small population, you know, it's not like Khartoum. Khartoum has millions of residents, so it's like in proportion is not that big. But when you talk about small cities like Al-Gadarif or Kassala, in comparison, this is like almost like quarter of the population or more.
The president, President al-Bashir, has not made many statements, but he has made a few since the protests began. And he is saying that he's not going anywhere, but then he also makes promises about the economic crisis, that things are going to get better. What do people make of that?
Well, I think he's arrogant, and I think these promises are not for the people protesting. It's for his own people to placate them and not to lose them. And I don't think this is something for the well-being of the economy of the country as a whole. He always had catered to his patronage. He never catered for the bigger community or the bigger society or the population of Sudan. You know what I mean? So if he promises that and he has any intention to deliver, it will be for a very small group of people who are his affiliates. You know what I mean? Just in a way of him to keep his patronage.
That's Sudanese American human rights advocate Azaz Al-Shami speaking with me in our VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. this past hour. An analyst says rather than beg for funds from the international community, the South Sudan government should use its own resources, including oil revenue, to implement the revitalized peace deal. The government and other parties who signed the deal have repeatedly blamed a lack of funds from international donors for delays in implementing that deal. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Juba.
The National Pre-Transitional Committee, the body tasked with overseeing implementation of the revitalized peace deal during an 8 months pre-transitional period, has yet to come up with a budget. The Joint Defense Board, a body implementing the security arrangements, says it requires nearly $60 million to assemble, canton, train, and unify the various forces into one national army, money it says it doesn't have. Major General Lul Roy Kwong is South Sudan People's Defense Forces spokesman and a member of the board. He said a week ago that the former warring parties have yet to raise the required amount of money to do the work.
There was a proposal on having 14, generally 14, for these 14 to be up and running, to have facilities, medical facilities, water points, shelters. That's the basic requirement. It will require $59 million, and nobody is available to do that, to give us that funding. That's the projection. So the practical problem we have is the problem of funding.
The ceasefire transitional security arrangements monitoring and verification mechanism, or CITISAM VM, the body monitoring South Sudan's permanent ceasefire, says it too faces budgetary constraints. Major General Desta Abiche, CITISAM VM chairman, said at the start of yesterday's CITISAM VM meeting in Juba that the body asked for funds from donors and the government without success.
We have not been able to secure the 2019 budget for CITISAM VM monitors. Since November 2018, for last 3 months, monitors are not paid their salary. It is my hope that our donors can understand that the challenge which CITES and VM are facing currently. In addition, we are not able to secure the national monitor's budget. Since I discussed with several donors and partners, I did not receive positive response and directions.
Abiche says the matter has been referred to the National Pre-Transitional Committee. But Jock Madud Jock, a senior policy analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute, says rather than wait for donors, the government should step up and fund implementation of the deal.
It is time that we stop crying for outside help and start doing things for ourselves with whatever little money we have, so that a trust can be built between citizens and the state, between citizens and the ordinary citizens and the leaders. Time is now for all to show what they are made of. Time is not on our side to keep crying and calling for outsiders to come and solve the problems that we created.
Jock says the government has money from oil and non-oil revenue sectors that it can use to fund implementation of the deal.
It is not possible for a country, a sovereign entity, with all the resources available to it, including the oil resources and the oil revenue that we have been hearing about. The oil price has gone up, the production level has gone up, and yet we are always hearing from the government saying that there is no money.
Government Information Minister Michael Makwe says the former warring parties have yet to come up with detailed budget proposal for implementing the deal.
We cannot talk about funding now because, after all, we have not yet come out with the final budget. However, the received money, which has already been deposited by the government into the accounts of the NPTC in Sudanese pound, and that amount is what is being used mostly for the accommodation.
Makwe says the government will deposit more money in the NPTC account, but did not specify how much money that would be or when it will happen. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Is South Sudan's maternal mortality rate falling? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the meaning of your name?
My name, like Lake, mean kingdom. Then Moses, someone who was dedicated by God to bring the Ten Commandments.
My name is Nafisa, and the meaning is calmness. Yes, I come to realize a name follows somebody. Like me, I find out that in most situations, even when somebody tries to upset me, I try as much as I can to be calm. In most situations, I don't really show my anger.
My name is Ibrahim. Okay, my surname is Chilunda, meaning a leader.
My name is Araba, and in Ghana, it's part of a traditional naming custom, if you may call it. Like, depending on what day you're born, you're assigned a certain name. And so because I was born on Tuesday, my name is Araba.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. The South Sudan government says it is working to reduce maternal mortality across the country by some 10% over the next 3 years. The undersecretary in South Sudan's health ministry says the government is training more and more health workers to reduce the mortality rate among mothers. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Makur Karyom, undersecretary in South Sudan's health ministry, acknowledges that there has been a chronic shortage of health workers to provide reproductive health services across the country. He says the government is quickly training more health workers to reduce the nation's maternal mortality rate even further.
In the next 3 years, we are aiming at reduction of maternal mortality by up to 10%. So that's at least in the short term. But of course, our long-term plan is to have a zero maternal mortality. No woman should die while giving birth. That is a natural function.
10 years ago, the rate of maternal mortality was 2,054 women per 100,000 live births. That is more than 60,000 deaths of mothers during childbirth, according to the United Nations Population Fund Birth. Over the past 9 years, South Sudan's maternal mortality rate dropped to 780 women who die due to labor complications per 100,000 live births. Koryom says improved maternal health is due to the steady increase in the number of trained health workers, especially nurses and midwives, and to build the infrastructure.
When you go around here now, you see the big buildings coming up here, there at Juba Teaching Hospital. They will be commissioned in the next 4 to 5 months. You cannot put those big buildings into use if you don't have skilled personnel. So to address the issues of health in South Sudan, you've got to have both infrastructure, well-equipped, and skilled personnel.
When South Sudan became independent in 2011, the entire country had only 3 health sciences training institutes and 9 qualified midwives, Koryom says. There are now 25 health sciences training institutes and more than 900 qualified midwives and nurses graduated in the past 8 years. Koryom says the doctor-to-patient ratio is about 3.5 doctors per 10,000 people as compared to 0.005 doctors per 10,000 people in 2011. He says the current ratio of nurses to patients is 4.5 nurses per 10,000 people compared to 0.5% to 10,000 patients in 2011. Repen Kamis, chairperson of the South Sudan Nurse and Midwifery Association, agrees the nation's high maternal mortality remains a big problem and more must be done to lower the number.
One of the strategies could be still training, opening more schools to train more numbers, because the health science institutions currently training nurses and midwives are not covering the whole country. They're only in specific places like Juba, Wau, Maridi. It's not covering the whole country, but the population is huge. Usually when we are doing intake, the people who are applying are huge, but then we cannot take them all because the capacity to accommodate them is not there.
Koryom says donors have played a key role in improving healthcare services in South Sudan. Only 2.5% of South Sudan's 2018-2019 81 billion South Sudanese pound budget has been allocated to the health sector. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The United Nations 2030 Sustainable Development Goals are ambitious global targets and a universal call to action to end poverty, protect the planet, and ensure that all people enjoy peace and prosperity. But meeting those goals has not been easy. During a meeting at the Human Rights Commission in Geneva this week, speakers talked about the frustration on an overall failure of the SDGs. As Ian Dang Bior reports for VOA, they say financial restrictions, poor governance, and corruption are all partly to blame.
By 2030, the UN wants to eliminate poverty, hunger, and attain gender equality, along with 14 other ambitious goals. But attaining the 17 Sustainable Development Goals has been challenging. Peggy Hicks, Director of Thematic Engagement, Special Procedures, and the Right to Development Division in the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, said at the Geneva meeting that UN agencies need to move quicker.
We need to accelerate. It is absolutely the case that we know that we are not as far along as we need to be to achieve the SDGs, and so it will take more than just continuing in the patterns that we currently have. And so with that, I charge all of us present here in Geneva, where I think there is a fundamental recognition that human rights are part of the equation. Many states have very, very compellingly put to us and to the Human Rights Council how important they think the SDGs are for human rights and how important human rights are to the SDGs.
The UN Statistics Division says the number of people living in extreme poverty fell significantly from 1.7 billion in 1999 to 767 million in 2013. By 2015, maternal mortality rates dropped by 37% compared to rates 15 years earlier. But that progress may not be coming fast enough. DevEx, a media entity that informs the development community, wrote last year that progress on the SDGs is uneven, adding that the rate of progress is not sufficient to meet the targets. Michael O'Flaherty, director of the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights, says observers blame the slow progress on several different issues.
The financial dimension was emphasized, but so also were issues of poor governance and corruption. And I would add as one fourth element of the lagging behind, the extent to which we still do not get the SDGs as genuinely global, as impacting for every EU member state.
O'Flaherty says any approach to the SDGs that does not involve the grassroots level, the civil society, and people in villages will ultimately fail.
It's not just about inviting them in, respecting them, and listening, but it's also about protecting. Again, that context of human rights under threat. The partners we need to bring to the table are themselves sometimes at grave risk.
The UN calls the Sustainable Development Goals a blueprint to achieve a better and more sustainable future. It remains to be seen if that blueprint to make the world safer and better for all will be achieved. O'Flaherty thinks it can be done if stakeholders involve the most vulnerable, including women and children. Ayen Dangbior, VOA News, Washington.
The president of Kenya has vowed to track down those responsible who attacked a five-star hotel called the Nuset Hotel in Nairobi, killing 21 people. Security forces have arrested 9 people, including the girlfriend of one of the 5 attackers, all of whom were killed. The Somalia-based Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the 20-hour siege on Tuesday. They call it retaliation for U.S. President Donald Trump's controversial decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. However, several analysts believe the attack was targeted more at Kenya for its troop commitment in Somalia in the multinational pursuit of Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab staged an attack in 2013 that killed 67 people in Nairobi's Westgate Shopping Center. The Kenyan Red Cross says everyone who had been in the hotel has been accounted for. Officials say all 5 attackers were killed. U.S. Ambassador Robert F. Gotek issued a statement that also dismissed what he called false reports on social media that the U.S. knew about the attack in advance and warned Americans to stay away from the area. Kenyan police say the perpetrators of Tuesday's terrorist attack on that luxury hotel have been eliminated, and President Uhuru Kenyatta is assuring the public that it's safe. But the incident could have a far-reaching impact on the nation's tourism industry. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The attack on the hotel complex came just as Kenya's tourism had mostly rebounded from Al-Shabaab's 2013 attack on an upscale Nairobi mall, which contributed to a 20% drop in tourism the following year. Al-Shabaab says it carried out Tuesday's attack, although that has not been verified. Whoever was responsible, a similar decline in tourist traffic following this attack could be devastating. Government statistics show that 10% of Kenya's economy is related to tourism and travel. Ed Fuller is a travel industry expert who led Marriott Hotels International Division for over 2 decades.
Keep in mind, this isn't the first bomb in Nairobi. It will be very significant.
Fuller notes that Kenya's tourism industry is different from that of many destinations.
Kenya is not a mass market for tourism, but it's a very high-end market for tourism because of the nature of the touring that is done there.
That mostly means safaris, where tourists pay big money to experience the country's wildlife, such as lions, leopards, giraffes, rhinos, crocodiles, and baboons, in comfort.
It's an expensive trip for most people. It's a lifelong planning trip, and that is hard currency coming from Europe, Asia, and the Americas and Australia. So Kenya Air is impacted because that is one of the major carriers in that area. And you also have the immediate impact on the ground for the staff that works with all the tourists that come in there seasonally. And you also have an impact on the hotel.
In Fuller's experience, international market reactions to terrorism vary according to region. He says American news media tend to report terrorist attacks in a way that exaggerates the actual threat, and Asian tourists tend to be extra cautious. He says Europeans are more accustomed to volatility, so are often more willing to take a risk. But he adds that from every angle, Kenyan authorities face a huge marketing challenge.
Kenya is a brand. The United States is a brand. And when you're selling yourself to the rest of the world, anything that impacts your brand has impact on your success. And I have had discussions with people who say, you know, I'm planning to go on a safari. And I've said, you know, you may want to just stay in Tanzania and skip Kenya this year because things are a little shaky there.
Professor Robert Solomon, who teaches business and globalization at New York University, says the only way Kenya's government can regain consumer confidence is to project safety and stability over the long term.
What tourists need to see is not just one-off measures taken by a particular government, but they need to see a track record of safety, and they need to see a track record of years that have gone by without incident. And then and only then will tourists come back in any kind of meaningful way. If we see these kinds of events on a regular basis, and I know that Kenya has struggled with terrorism in the past, then they will change their plans and they will avoid places like Kenya.
Despite efforts by Kenya's security forces, the African Union, the United States, and others to defeat al-Shabaab, the Somalia-based group maintains its ability to attack targets with fighters willing to die during the act. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
That is our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Sika Andaya by Emir Juba.
David Stewart Warkozy, producer Isaac Isanga. Amir Katolo Sim. Baba betala sabagalo masi shokon, abo betala sabagalo masi shokon. Belefo beka de elebe sandaya, belefo beka de elebe sandaya. Kuliyom sikandaya mini saba, kuliyom sikandaya mini saba,
kuliyom sikandaya.
Ale kolo bitala tala bitala minape atfal kolo bijere jere bijere minape nyer kukat kolo bitala tala bitala minape atfal kolo bijere jere bijere minape you fetishulom lokuma 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 esham you fetishulom kuteriga teriga teriga ma esham you fetishulom lokuma 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 esham. You fed us to them, to deriga, 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 hayalum.
Kuliyam, kuliyam, sika, andaya, mini saba. Kuliyam, kuliyam, sika, andaya, mini saba. Kuliyam, kuliyam, sika, andaya, mini saba. Kuliyam, kuliyam, sika, andaya, mini saba.
Ana marufu, papa de hete. Ana marufu, dali papa de gida. Betala saba, kaloma si shokon. Betala saba, kaloma si shokon. Belefo beka dele besandaya. Belefo beka dele mahalba. Belefo beka dele mahalot. Belefo beka dele besandaya. Kuluyom kuluyom sikandaya.
We've been listening to Emir Juba with the song Sika Andaya. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of audio engineer Wojtek Zoniak and director Nadia Taha, thanks for listening. We're glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Baba be ya fi bet liko.
goje na mafi baba be ya fi be mi goje na mafi be dala baba mi goje